It's Friday, the 1st of June, and you're listening to the Defence Report Weekly Recap. We've got a bumper episode lined up for you today, as we once again cast a backwards glance at the week that was in defence, military and security news. My name is Keith Mallon, host for this week's show, and the supremo of all the menial tasks no one else can be bothered with here at Defence Report Towers. But that's okay, because I'm looking forward to a rapturous weekend of festivities here in London as we celebrate Queen Elizabeth II's Diamond Jubilee. And speaking of ageing old queens, I'm joined on the line by our editor, Robert Densmore.
Thank you, Keith.
From the courts of King Albert II in Brussels, we're joined by Jonathan Dowdle.
Thanks, Keith.
And a very special guest on this week's recap, and King of Defence journalists and bloggers and scourge of errant military press offices around the world, we're delighted to welcome the one and only Mr. David Axe. Hello, David.
Great to be here.
So, without further ado, my lords, ladies and gentlemen, we'll kick off this week's rapid-fire headlines. Number one, the Queen may be celebrating 60 glorious years on the throne, but her army may have to wait a bit longer to celebrate the arrival of new armoured reconnaissance vehicles. The curse of the Inglorious Fres programme seems to be striking again, and rumours surface that the Scout SV programme may be cut or delayed. We'll keep an eye on that one. Number two, Israeli Chief of Defence, Lieutenant General Benny Gantz, confirms that his special forces have stepped up covert attacks beyond their borders in recent months. No specific details were given as to where, but I'd imagine that Iranian nuclear scientists are probably checking for bogeymen under their beds a bit more frequently. And number three, a great piece of reporting in the New York Times this week focused on President Obama's assassination of terrorist suspects around the globe. Now, the lack of judicial process is nothing to worry about because the president has read a few books by Thomas Aquinas, so it's fine. So, Mr. Densmore, you've got an update on the latest cyber attack to be uncovered, something called the Flame Virus.
This was essentially, as many of you know, Kaspersky Labs has uncovered a malicious program called Flame. All we know is that the cyber espionage tool, and it's highly capable. So LA Times comes out today, and they say the following, quote, Flame can copy and steal data and audio files, turn on a computer microphone and record all the sounds in its vicinity, take screenshots, read documents and emails, and capture passwords and logins. The program can communicate with other computers in its radius via the infected computer's Bluetooth capability and locate their whereabouts even without an internet connection. I think we all downplay cyber a bit because military spending programs tend to go on ad nauseum about the threat without being too specific. But it piggybacks on a facet of cyber attack that we really don't focus on much, we don't discuss much, and that's the very passive espionage component. And I think this is probably a reaction to, in some ways, you know, recent Pentagon statements about putting missiles down chimneys from state actors who are overtly launching something short of a kinetic attack through cyberspace. So it's cleverly passive. I think that's an important feature. And let's not forget that at Tallinn, NATO, and this is at the Estonia conference, and meets, you know, regularly talk about cyber threats. NATO's recently called for a massive expansion of their joint cyber command. This happened at the end of March. And so it's all kind of at a fortuitous time. And Tallinn is really important. I think it's probably underestimated in terms of setting the threat level and defining threats. Yes. I think this comes at a really important time. We just need to keep an eye on it.
David, John. David, John, do you have anything to add on that one?
I do indeed. I think on this, I remain a little bit sceptical, Rob. I mean, you mentioned that perhaps we've been downplaying it a little bit, and I retain that scepticism. I spoke to some officers from ENISA, which is the European Network Information Security Agency, which is very much the EU counterpart to the Centre in Tallinn for NATO, and they basically said that this is a little bit old hat. It may be very capable, but each individual capability has been around for a long time. This is just a particularly sophisticated package. And second of all, we say cyber and espionage, but cyber espionage of what kind of data? If it's financial data, which many cyber attacks recently have been related to, whether it be oil transfers or carbon trading credits to the EU, then this may be a financially motivated attack, for example. So bearing that in mind, I remain a little bit skeptical until I see, like we did with Shady Rat, these signatures coming up all over defense contractors, in which case then, yes. Direct military importance.
Anyway, John, moving swiftly along, you've got some updates on the horrendous goings-on in Syria.
Well, yeah, horrendous indeed. So this is the revelation of a systematic and brutal massacre by Syrian government forces, including the point-blank execution of bound and gagged civilians. And these details are important because this is now being viewed as the final nail in the coffin of the UN-backed Kofi Annan peace plan. And indeed, Free Syrian Army spokespeople have been talking openly the last week about rendering the shaky ceasefire null and void in light of this particular atrocity. So with talk of civil war on everyone's lips, thoughts are turning once again to what the West can do, a military intervention. And leading the charge has been the newly elected French President Hollande, who reiterated to the media this week that air-based military strikes are not excluded, in his words, from his defence plan's list of options for Syria, provided a UN resolution can be secured to authorise it. And US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has also been talking in this vein today. Now, of course, any such UN resolution seems a distant prospect because Russia, another permanent UN Security Council member, remains committed to blocking all such sanctions that may lead to regime change. And we've discussed this on this podcast before. So what I want to ask you guys about are, what options do we have left short of a UN resolution? Some people have been talking about unilateral or NATO-led blockades by air and sea to stop Iranian and Russian arms shipments to Assad to starve his military resources. Others have talked to varying degrees of arming the Free Syrian Army, and others have spoken even more directly of creating safe zones for insurgents to use in neighbouring Turkey. What I want to ask is, do these ideas sound feasible? And what else can Western allies do if not, if Russia continues to refuse to play ball regarding a UN resolution?
Anyone care to venture an answer?
I think it's going to be a case of, once again, we've already talked about this week, special forces advisors assisting Ugandan forces in the hunt for Joseph Kony. I think we all know in the back of our heads that that's a bit more kinetic than anyone's willing to admit. We all know that anything less than that is going to be completely ineffective in Syria.
Staying with that special forces theme, and finally coming to a story that has set the online world ablaze in the last few days. Earlier this week, David Axe posted a story in the online magazine The Diplomat, quoting the commander of US Special Forces Command in Korea. And according to his story, Brigadier General Neil Tully stated at a recent conference that US Special Forces had parachuted into North Korea to carry out covert surveillance missions on military installations. Now, a brief potted history, and I'll be as accurate as I can here, of what followed, is that the US military accused Dave of essentially misquoting the general and fabricating a story out of hypothetical remarks. As Dave referred back to his handwritten notes, the diplomat pulled the story, and I hope you don't mind me saying, Dave, but they pretty much hung him out to dry, and it all kicked off from there. And the plot thickened when a number of other journalists backed up Dave's account of what Tully had actually said at the conference. So this then prompted the US military to retract its allegations against Dave, and Tully had to come out and say that he was not misquoted, but rather that he had expressed himself poorly, if I can paraphrase that. Now, Dave, this has obviously been a pretty trying week for you, and I presume the good general is going to enjoy a long chat with our tea and biscuits as well. But what I'd like to hear from you is, why do you think the military handled the story in such a bad way? And what element of the story do you think they were trying to suppress?
I think that there are a number of feasible explanations for what's really going on here. I'm going to propose the most innocent of them, which is panic by one person and a problem with time zones. So it's pretty firmly established now that I did not misquote Brigadier General Neil Tully when he said, quote, "We send," end quote, South Korean and U.S. special forces into North Korea to do, quote, "special reconnaissance," end quote, of buried North Korean military targets. That I have him on the record, multiple corroborating sources. So the question then is, if that's what he said, is that also what he meant to say? He now says, of course, that's not what he meant to say, but doesn't dispute that he actually said it. So here's what I think is one possible explanation. There was a disconnect in his mind, between his mind and his mouth as he spoke. He did not realize that the magnitude of what he had said until after the story was published, several days after he actually said the words, and after Asian media had a few hours to process the original report and to weave it into their own stories and for it to disseminate. Once that began happening, so that would be very, very late at night on Monday, U.S. time, Eastern time where I am, when that began to happen, Brigadier General Tully panicked. That's my assumption. That's what I believe happened. He then contacted his public affairs officer, a Colonel Withington, part of U.S. Forces Korea, and gave Colonel Withington a statement. And the statement said that I, quote, "made up," end quote, the comments I attributed to him, to Tolley. And Colonel Withington, and I checked in with Colonel Withington, he did not have a transcript of the event, and being the late hour that it was, he did not have easy access to me, for one, nor did he have access to event organizers or to the Pentagon and the Pentagon's public affairs apparatus. He released Brigadier General Tolley's original report, I guess you could say, his statement indicating, accusing me of making up the comments. Colonel Withington released that without corroborating his boss's own claims. So by late at night, my time on Monday, so within a few hours after the story had been released, and panic is rapidly spreading across the Korean Peninsula, it amounted to the general's word against my word, with no easy way to corroborate anything because of the time. So, fast forward a few hours. By that time, so by morning my time on Tuesday, General Tolley had released his statement, and it had begun to dominate the news, the claim that a reporter made up quotations and fabricated a story. That was dominating the news.
Dave, this is... This is pretty extraordinary stuff, and I'm starting to get a pattern here, and I'm sure Rob will want to jump in as well, but this is really putting the special ed into special forces, because these are experienced media professionals who are meant to be able to handle something, but instead we're just getting, to quote the great Malcolm Tucker, a bit of an omni-shambles here. Rob, what do you make of this? You know, we're listening to this account from David, and it seems almost too extraordinary for words.
I feel bad for Dave, and I think that there's the larger casualty here is the reading public, consumers of news out there who risks endangering the reputation of journalists and what they do, and this is a classic bungle of I've heard generals do this in press conferences, but particularly I have to say American spokesmen, when they talk, they tend to revert into this mixing of cases sometimes, and so it's very right that he's been called on this, because this is not exactly one of those minor issues you want to gloss over. It has to be very clear, and if this guy can't do his job, which basically is being a spokesman for the military, then you know he needs to go somewhere else. And this, I think, is a classic. Should I say FUBAR? I guess that's probably the best thing to say. But Dave, I just want to ask you a quick question here. Yes. What do you think are the lessons learned from what happened? I mean, there's obviously still fallout going on from this, and you know, you've gotten your side of the story out. If it was someone, perhaps who was a smaller freelancer or a stringer, didn't have a name, you know, they might be done out of a career because of this. But what do you think are the lessons? Is there anything you could have done differently to help prevent something like this?
Oh, sure. I could have done a lot more reporting. So, you know, if I had requested an additional interview with Tolley and then gone through his media handlers in order to get that and then conducted that interview, if I had gone to other sources within U.S. Special Operations Command. So, I mean, there are a number of things I could have done to add to the story, which would have either complicated it or simplified it. Who knows? I didn't do any of that because my job as a diplomat, as a blogger, is not to write features. I do periodically do that, but on one-off assignments. My ongoing relationship with a diplomat is once a week to provide a scrap of reporting that's often a single interview with a single individual and just simply, you know, relay that little bit of reporting. You could make the
argument.
Yeah.
My follow-on question then is, and this is one of those areas that I think we're breaking ground for bloggers, because they've become a very prominent part of reporting now, and the diplomat just kind of yanked the rug out from under your feet. You know, is there a contractual agreement? I mean, do they not have an editorial line that they follow with their bloggers, or is it a different policy that they have with their staff? How does that work?
This is a very freewheeling world that I inhabit. I work for scores of media, and with only a handful of them do I have some sort of contract that lays out who's responsible for what and what the consequences are of X, Y, or Z. So with a diplomat, I do not have that. I have a verbal agreement to do a certain amount of reporting within a certain frame, and that's it. And I get paid a certain amount based on that. That's it. It's entirely verbal. That's the case. That's usually the case with freelance reporters in my field.
I'm wondering, Dave, how does that reflect upon the role of blogging in news then? Because you know, I mean, as Rob says, you know, this led to a major story. It was picked up and it was ran, you know, verbatim from your quotes by various newspapers. How does that reflect upon the role of blogging when you're operating in that kind of environment but can break stories which can cause this this storm?
It's very rare that that this kind of blogging breaks through into the wider media, which is one of the reasons why I was so shocked by what happened, because I've been doing this for 10 years, and on many occasions I have reported things that I thought were astounding and major breaking news. For instance, U.S. Army regular troops forcing Afghan civilians to join the Afghan Army. I reported that and pushed that one hard with feature-length reporting. That never broke through. Nobody even cared about that. The whole Joseph Kony 2012 thing, I was 2 years ahead of that in terms of advocating for the current role that U.S. Special Forces play.
Sorry, no, I'm just saying, if you're to blame for the Kony 2012 phenomenon, we'll all be very upset. Gentlemen, we're running out of time now, so I kind of need to cut it short. Just, Rob, any closing thoughts?
No, I mean, I would just say that because we, and I think John was pointing this, but because we now rely on blogging, and because we're blogging and microblogging is very much now a part of our news consumption, a very critical part, those checks and balances need to be in place. You know, I look at part of the problem here, the bad guy, I would say is the diplomat. You know, they really dropped the ball on this one. They need to back up their staff. They need to back up their right. Even if you have someone reporting, you know, on the fly, and that verbal agreement is in place, they need to stand tall on that.
We will leave it all there. John, Rob, thanks ever so much for joining us, as always. And David, special thanks to you for taking time out of what's been a very busy and hectic week to join the Weekly Recap.
It has. Hey, I'm sorry, I know that you've got sort of parameters here, but have we established that the Pentagon has retracted their accusations against me? I just want to make sure that's clear in the conversation.
Yep. What I have seen on the internet and from the links that you've been posting, it does certainly look to me like your name has been completely vindicated, and that totally has completely...
Okay, I just want to make sure we're current in this particular broadcast so that nobody picks up on this and says that that there's still any doubt that I lied.
Right. David, thanks ever so much, and thank you all. It's been a busy recap, and we will see you all again next week. Thank you.